York Communications Company, and Stan Cook of the Chicago Tribune, came in periodically to talk the situation over with me. I remember Stan encouraging me to stay the course. "You just have to keep up the steady pressure, like leaning on a gate, to gradually shut it." And despite everything, there actually were some lighter moments. Phil Jalen sent me a note in early December saying that he was so pleased that Natalie Panetti, the manager of employee services for the Post, who had become the de facto assigner of jobs, had just informed him that, in addition to his regular duties on B Press, he had been designated an assistant supervisor of stuffers. His note said, "This is just to tell you how honored I am by this assignment and the expression it conveys of your confidence and trust in me. Upward mobility is the hallmark of a great newspaper. I will do my darndest to be worthy of this latest opportunity you have provided me to serve you in new and interesting ways." As time wore on for those of us doing the dirty and seemingly interminable tasks in the mailroom, in order to divert ourselves from the tedium, we started writing notes to people on the front page. I believe it is illegal to write notes on second-class mail, but that didn't occur to us, or if it did, we didn't care, as we scribbled away to whatever name turned up who might be a friend or even an acquaintance. Who knows what these people thought when they got their Sunday Post along with a message, "Help, I'm a prisoner in the Washington Post mailroom." Through all this time, of course, negotiations with the Pressmen's Union were continuing. From the beginning, as Mark said, we were willing to maintain their high incomes, even counting the overtime they had earned in the past due to absurd work rules. But what we wanted was to bring under control those feather-bedding practices that were severely affecting our capacity to produce a quality paper. In short, as Larry Wallace summarized, we were trying, through collective bargaining, to regain some measure of control over the operation of the pressroom in order that there will be a more efficient, more productive, less costly, and less wasteful operation. Our earlier offer was on the table, and at one point in mid-November, a meeting was set at which the pressmen were scheduled to make a counterproposal. When the session convened, they said they had changed their minds and would not produce one. We were astonished, since by this time we were publishing marginally profitable newspapers, and were surprised that the pressmen still seemed to think that no movement on their part was required. Talks were recessed until the mediation service believed they could be useful. In the meantime, we tried to negotiate with the other unions, but they gave precedence to a settlement between us and the pressmen, so we were stalemated. During this period, those who had been charged with the violence and damage in the beginning of the strike were called before a grand jury. Every one of them pleaded the Fifth Amendment, as did Dugan, who said he had no personal knowledge of the violence in the pressroom. From the beginning, he claimed that the riot was unplanned, a simple emotional outburst by craftsmen who felt frustrated and were overwrought. Prosecutors were considering granting selective immunity in exchange for information and threatened to prosecute the pressmen for contempt if they continued to refuse to testify. We were now in December, with virtually no movement, although we had put forth another offer which the pressmen had ignored. The strike had been going on for 9 weeks, during which we had made several offers of generous benefits and certain job guarantees and securities in exchange for modification of unacceptable work practices. Finally, the pressmen made their first offer, orally, not in writing, proposing only one minor change in work practices, for which they asked an additional $37 a week. Obviously, we were still far apart. The next day, December 4th, was important because we made a final offer. To keep the whole thing from dragging on, we had decided to make what Mark called the comprehensive, definitive, and final settlement offer. This was an offer that I believe was generous. A pressman's base pay would have gone immediately to $17,318.60, higher than that of any pressman at any other newspaper in the United States at that time. It gave pressmen the opportunity to earn as much as the then-current average in the pressroom by working more reasonable hours, only 5 days a week, and more if they chose reasonable overtime. The contract would have ended the practice of back-to-back shifts. We promised job security and noted that any de-escalation in manning the presses would be by attrition, not through firings. There were other add-ons, overtime, holiday bonuses, and a $400,000 package to divide up. It was an offer the pressmen could have accepted, and would have done well to, and one that we could live with, which the final offer had to be. There was a secret meeting on the eve of the final contract offer, but nothing happened. Dugan, as usual, was both arrogant and personal. He called Mark Mayer and Larry Wallace liars and told them to tell Catherine Graham to take her contract proposal and shove it. We had warned the union, it wasn't a threat or a ploy, that we thought this offer was the best we could come forward with. We re-emphasized, as we had steadfastly maintained throughout, that we considered the return to work of those pressmen who caused the destruction in our pressroom non-negotiable and outside the bargaining process. Local 6 voted 249-5 to reject our offer. Why didn't the pressmen accept the contract? I'm sure there are as many answers as there were individual pressmen. Perhaps they were holding out, hoping we would cave in, and remembering that we always had. Jim Dugan himself was certainly a factor, as was Charlie Davis of the Stereotypers, Dugan's first henchman. Dugan had always been an able leader, but had undoubtedly gotten an inflated ego from his perceived victory over John Prescott the night of the Wildcat strike in 1973. He seemed to believe that he was the strong man in the building and could always make management back down in the end. He projected the attitude that he was going to fix us, to show the management of the Washington Post Company who was really in charge. Not only would there be no concessions, but in fact, he was out to make further gains. From this, the union never wavered, through the entire strike. To some extent, Dugan was a prisoner of his power and successful past, and of the people who did the damage. He had to ask us to take back the men who damaged our presses. We steadfastly refused. After the overwhelming turndown of our final offer by the union, it was a question of when, not if, to announce that we would start hiring replacement workers. This was the most sensitive and frightening moment of the whole strike. I had no idea what the reaction might be on the part of the guild, the pressmen, or the many strikers. We talked about the upcoming guild meeting, and whether we should tempt fate by making our announcement just before or waiting until just after. But there was no perfect moment. Finally, Mark made the decision to move ahead as quickly as possible and set the date for the eve of a guild meeting, which worried me considerably, but which proved to be a wise and gutsy judgment. 3 days after the Pressman's Union's rejection of our final offer, December 10th, Mark and I walked down to the fifth-floor newsroom, the biggest available place, to a meeting of all those still working. There, I announced our intention to hire replacement workers, outlining our attempt to negotiate the terms of the final offer. I then described the alternative to not hiring new pressmen as the continued publication of the paper by an already exhausted crew for who knew how many months, emphasizing that, based on past patterns, there was no indication that 10 more weeks or even 10 more months of bargaining would change any attitudes. Continuing to negotiate seemed likely to lead only to more sterile debate, and, as I said to someone at the time, unjustified hopes and added delay in reaching settlements with the other unions. The truth is that as far as the pressmen are concerned, it is just too late. I told those gathered in the newsroom that members of Local 6 were being informed by letter that if our contract offer was not approved by midnight of the next Sunday, 4 days later, we would begin hiring permanent replacements. I added that the pressmen, as individuals, with the exception of those who had been known to participate in the violence, could return to their jobs in the pressroom. I also tried to speak directly to members of the other craft unions, emphasizing that we wanted to reach agreements as speedily as possible with all those unions whose contracts had expired on September 30th. I knew this action was legal, but, as I told those gathered there that morning, it was more important for me to think about whether it was humanly right. In the end, I said to the gathering, "Like the decisions made by each of you who continued to work in the strike, My decision was neither simple nor easy, and like your decisions, it required me to weigh the claims of a variety of responsibilities. My conclusion is that I cannot in conscience permit a situation to continue in which men and women in our trade unions, many of whom have worked here for many years, are faced with a bleak future because they must honor the picket lines of a group of men who are the highest paid craft union workers in the building. These members of our other unions have already forfeited many hundreds of thousands of dollars in wages for the sake of striking pressmen who continue to draw pay for their work at other newspapers, who created this situation by their irresponsible and violent acts, and who have rejected out of hand an offer which would have made them the best paid and most financially secure members of their craft working at any paper in this country. I concluded by saying, "It is a sober moment for this place and for all of us. The consequences of what we have been forced to do have been thought about hard. I believe we have done what is responsible and right for the paper, for the 2,000 union people who work here, for the honor of the institution itself, and for the community we serve." My statement was greeted by tense silence. Mark followed up. The two of us took a few questions and then left. The next day, the Post ran a full-page open letter from Mark titled, "Why the Washington Post Has Taken Action to End the Strike and Return to Normal Operations," which was Ted Van Dyke's work. We also ran an ad in the classified section of the paper for immediate openings for experienced or inexperienced production personnel for the pressroom. To our amazement, early the next morning there were about 700 people lined up in front of the building to be interviewed. In the end, we had 1,000 applicants, from whom we hired very carefully, and at first very slowly, a cross-section of people right off the street and some who had worked at the paper during the strike. Our first hire was a black man who had stood on the line in silver platform shoes dressed in a long fur coat. One of the first of the new press men was Diane Elmore, now Patterson, formerly from advertising sales, who had worked on the presses throughout the strike, liking it so much that she chose to switch jobs. She is now an assistant superintendent for the mailroom at our Springfield plant. There were several Vietnamese men who had worked around the building in various temporary capacities who were hired and became star performers. One of the fine things Jim Cooper had done was to meet at my farm in Virginia with 6 of the pressroom supervisors who were union members, inviting them to return to work. They agreed to come back in, which they did only after we went to impasse and had started hiring and eventually helped with training the new people. Their return was a great step forward for us, but a difficult one for them. They were all visibly shaken, pale, and frightened in their first days back on the job. We brought in 2 people to begin training our new pressmen in a rigorous 2-week training program. We had to lower our standards a little to go faster, but we found such highly motivated and qualified people that they rose rapidly through the ranks. I had been concerned that there would be violent confrontations between the pickets and the applicants. To my surprise, there were none. "You might have had 200 press operators picketing out there who were fearful for their jobs," recalled Jim Cooper later, "but you had 700 people, many of whom were black, out there hoping for jobs that blacks hadn't even been allowed to think about. It would have taken a very stupid person to try to oppose them." Pressures rose on us after the announcement about hiring. Mark, Don, and I were called to go before the D.C. City Council to answer questions. Dugan had asked for a meeting with the council and had actually said, "I used to live in D.C., for whatever that's worth," to which Council Chairman Sterling Tucker had said, "That's not worth anything." Again, the racial issue helped counteract the general pro-union sympathy, because when we informed Tucker that there were no blacks in the union, he concluded it was a racist union and decided not to help the pressmen in any way. The president of the Greater Washington Central Labor Council asked me to meet with Mayor Walter Washington and Jim Dugan, accusing us of importing strike breakers. By this time we had had to borrow a few pressmen from other papers, and I explained by letter why we had had to do this, noting that we never brought in relief pressmen until we went to impasse in December, when our people were exhausted. I added that I couldn't see that the mayor's presence would change a situation of basic wide disagreement between the Post and Local 6, especially since the mediation service had participated from the beginning. There never was a meeting. Just at this time, more than 1,500 demonstrators staged a rally parading past the building to show solidarity with the unions. Several of us inside the building were clustered, discreetly hidden at an upstairs window, to watch the approaching parade. I was dismayed to see Charlie Davis at the head of the group with a sign that read, in big letters, "Phil shot the wrong Graham." I cringed and ran from the window. I couldn't believe that Charlie and I had once been on friendly, jocular terms. Oddly, the pressmen still didn't seem to feel threatened. Not even after our hiring began. They acted as though they believed it was only a matter of time before they'd be coming back in. In many ways, this attitude may have been a reflection of how unreal Dugan's perspective was. From the beginning, he appeared not to think that we could actually be running the presses. Even when the picketers heard the noise of the presses, he would insist we were somehow faking it. As we got stronger and stronger, he kept denying our successes. As late as the end of December, Dugan claimed on radio and television that our statements about the Post's circulation were misleading and way off base, asserting that we were dumping thousands of copies of the daily paper. In fact, by this time, daily circulation was down by only about 25,000 copies, and Sunday circulation by just 12,000. We had reached 98% of expectations for this time of year. Despite their seeming to believe that time was on their side, the pressmen appealed to George Meany, AFL-CIO president, for help. He in turn called me and said, "Catherine, the pressmen have called and want me to talk to you." I confess that my heart sank at his call. Meany could have seriously hurt us by starting boycotts and applying other political pressures, in essence by getting behind the pressmen's union. He asked me if I wanted him to come to the Post to talk. I knew Meany through my father, who had served with him on the War Labor Board. I respected him and liked him, and knew that he couldn't possibly cross the picket line. So I told him I'd go to him, which I did on December 17th, taking Mark along with me to Meany's office, only a couple of blocks away. When we were seated, George got right down to business, asking, "Would you take the pressmen back if they paid to fix the presses?" "No," I replied unequivocally. "The presses are fixed. We have already hired half the people we need. It's too late to take them back. We can't have them working side by side with non-union people." "Would you take them back if—" George kept raising the ante in one question after another. I kept explaining that we had crossed the bridge. They hadn't responded to any invitations to negotiate, and now we were launched on another path. Finally, he posed the ultimate difficult question. "What would you do if they accepted the contract?" Legally, of course, if they had at any time accepted the final contract, they would have been eligible for the remaining jobs. I took a deep breath, let my intuition take over, and replied, "I guess I'd slit my throat from ear to ear." There was a deafening silence for a moment, while George stared at me, and Mark went limp, looking as though he were going to slide right off the couch on which we both were sitting. But I knew George, and I thought I could level with him, and that was the truth. I also knew that he would understand what I meant. He was very political, with sensitive antennae. Finally, he reflected sadly, "Well, I offered to help the pressmen when this strike first started. I sent them a wire, and they never replied. Also, I just can't imagine people who would destroy their tools. I've never approved of that. That would never have happened in my day." We talked a little longer, then Mark and I rose to leave. Meany walked with us to the elevator, slowly and sorrowfully. As we were getting in, he said to me, "The Post is a great newspaper, and I knew and loved your father." Just before Christmas, we had our first big break when the paper handlers, who pushed the huge and heavy newsprint rolls to the presses, a job that was then being done by Don Graham, Mark Mayer, and others, settled their contract, the first union to do so. To the public, this didn't quite count as a breakthrough, however, because the pressmen's and other unions condescended to them, The paper handlers, being all black and lower skilled, were slightly different from the other crafts, but from our point of view it was a break, and it relieved us considerably. At the same time, the regional director of the National Labor Relations Board refused to issue a complaint filed by the union, accusing us of delaying or stalling tactics and refusing to bargain in good faith. Still, the tension was high. The pressmen's wives started to write me. Christmas Eve, a day I never dreamed would find us still in this strike situation, was hard for all of us. Ben's annual letter to me was especially poignant and understanding. He acknowledged that he felt I would never do anything more difficult. He was so right. He also said that his own New Year's wish was to have the turmoil ended so that we can return to our task of putting out the best paper in the world without compromise and without menace. I think the strike was especially difficult on Ben. He himself admitted later, "I have never been comfortable in or with the labor movement." Whereas I had been living through these months with people who were of one mind, he had had to live each day with people who were tormented by what they were doing in not supporting the union, reporters who had to be calmed and reassured constantly. I also recognized that what I was doing in trying to change the labor situation was something I had been working on for years, whereas for Ben, the strike was nothing but a mammoth interruption of what he had been trying to do for the past decade. In responding to Ben, I shared with him my view about how it would turn out. "I know it's going to be good, better than you think from every point of view. I pray it's over before too long, but it would be fatal to try to push it faster than it can go." On New Year's Eve, to my great distress and anger, the Star ran an open letter from a group called the Executive Committee of the Committee for a Fair Settlement. The letter urged round-the-clock bargaining to be mediated by the Federal Mediation Service, and if that failed, binding arbitration. It was endorsed by George Meany and signed by 100 people, including many civic leaders and liberals, among them Reverend Walter Fauntroy, Monsignor George Higgins of the Catholic Conference, Leon Kaiserling, former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, Reverend John Walker, Bishop of the Washington National Cathedral, Senator Hubert Humphrey, and Representative John Brademas, who later wrote me that his name had been used without permission. I believe that all the signers were being used, although many of them didn't realize it. They thought the position was a neutral one, that we had won the strike, but should now submit to an arbitrator what we had already won. They had little idea what the real issues were, but had simply let themselves be duped by the union. In fact, the ad was paid for by the Newspaper Guild, which was made clear at a press conference the same day the ad appeared, called by the members of the committee that had placed the ad. I sent letters to several of the signers whom I knew, including Hubert Humphrey, saying I was disappointed that they had let their names be used without at least asking to hear our side. Hubert wrote back immediately, saying he had thought the open letter was nothing but an appeal to both the post and the unions to try to settle the dispute, and he still didn't think it took sides. He added, however, "On second thought, it would have been better if I had kept my nose out of the dispute. It was one of those hasty decisions, and I suppose one that I would have been much better off never to have made," apologizing if it had caused me distress, which indeed it had. I wrote John Walker, too, sending him a package that was being mailed throughout the Washington metropolitan area by a group called Post Unions United, containing a reprint of the ad, along with a postcard addressed to the Post canceling a subscription, and a prepaid subscription card addressed to the Star. "There was hardly a need for fact-finding," I wrote, "nor is there any justification for arbitration of an issue that rightly belongs to the collective bargaining process." Bishop Walker replied that he was profoundly disturbed by the subversion of the purposes of the open letter and that he was withdrawing his name from the committee. My great friend Joe Rao, who had also been a signer of the ad in the Star, contributed to my worries by coming to me to say that he feared my obstinacy vis-à-vis the union was effectively acting as a wedge being driven between essential allies, the Liberal Labor Coalition. We spent 3 hours one afternoon at my house while he argued the necessity of taking the pressmen's union back, and I tried to explain why that couldn't happen. My differences with Joe reflected one of the ironies of the pressman's strike. It was difficult to find myself being viewed as anti-labor, and it was strange for me to find in my camp many people who normally would have been on the directly opposite side of the mat, and the reverse as well, with many of my friends taking a position contrary to mine. This strange switch was reflected in various situations throughout those long months of the strike. For example, Pat Buchanan, never one to support the Washington Post, wrote at the time that, although the company was a media cartel which ought to be broken up, and although the paper's editorial policies have encouraged the shift of economic power toward big labor, its fight with Local 6 is a fight it has to win. He managed to add about the company, it probably deserves what it gets. By January 6, 1976, we had hired 107 people as permanent replacements for the pressroom, with a white, non-white mix of about 50-50 and with almost 10% women. Beyond starting to train these new hires, the issue now was to get the other craft unions back. Not much progress was being made. The paper handlers, though they had voted to return, were not yet back at work because of a glitch with their international. A few individual craft workers had returned on their own initiative, but the overwhelming majority of them were still on strike or were respecting the picket lines of the striking unions. And in mid-January, the local pressmen's union filed a $20 million countersuit against the Post, claiming the newspaper had conspired to ultimately destroy the union entirely. Just a few days into the new year, the Star ran four articles on the strike, purporting to tell the full story, the story from management's side, from the union's side, and from the guilds. In reply to a reader who had canceled the Post after reading the Star's articles, I said, "I will ask the circulation department to stop your paper if you request, but if you are doing it as a result of reading the Star, this was the most outrageous, deliberate knife job any paper has done to another. I would cancel the Post myself if I depended on the Star article. I enclose my own view of the issues. If you still want your paper canceled, I will do so." The emotional stress of the entire strike and the losses on both sides were epitomized on February 10th when one of the pressmen, John Kloss, committed suicide. The coordinating committee of the Alliance for Labor and Community Action wired me immediately, saying, "You are responsible for the death of post-pressman John Kloss. When your greed for more profits made you decide to break the unions, you accepted the moral responsibility for all the inevitable human consequences which flowed from this decision. Your yellow attempt to lie your way out from this moral responsibility by printing in your paper, 'He was afraid to cross the union's picket lines,' was the lowest insult you could have made to a man and his family who have been strong unionists for over 30 years, 19 of them at the Post. All your and your cohort's money, lies, and paid flunkies will not let you hide from this fact that is burning into the souls of working people. John Kloss's blood is on your hands." I drafted a response that I never sent, perhaps because I was trying to be rational in what was an emotionally charged environment. I wanted to point out that the reason the news story that had appeared in the Post said John Kloss was afraid to cross the picket line was that that is what his suicide note had said. In the end, I saw no point in responding to what I viewed as intemperate and unfounded accusations. February 15th was possibly the key moment in the denouement of the strike. The mailers finally voted, 129-58, to accept a new contract and reported for work the next night. On February 17th, the Post's chapel of the Photo Engravers Union voted to accept our contract offer and return to work a few days later. The typographers, who were observing the picket line but were not on strike since they had a contract, came back in with them. We were still negotiating with three groups: the engineers, who held out until March 1st, the machinists, a majority of whom were back at work, and the building services union. At the end of February, Bob Kaiser, who had been covering the strike, wrote a long piece about everything that had taken place, which took over much of the Outlook section of the paper. Because it was a remarkably detached piece of reporting, It was widely applauded. I didn't agree with all that Bob wrote, but I believe newspapers have to let themselves be written about and have to live with it. Naturally, there had been a lot of press reaction to the strike during those long months. It ranged from very positive to the other extreme. One of the worst stories ran in the beginning by Elliot Marshall in the New Republic. Marshall had been a classmate of my youngest son, Steve, at Harvard, and was about 26 at the time. I called him and said that some of what he'd said was demonstrably wrong, and I could prove it. He said he was so sorry, but he had it from an impeccable source, the Star, and every good wish. I did not call his publisher. In January, there had appeared in Washington Monthly one of the last in a series of outrageous press pieces about the strike, this one by an ex-national editor of the Post, Ben Bagdikian, who since leaving the paper had made a cottage industry of criticizing us. His article was entitled "Maximizing Profits at the Washington Post." I sent a copy to Don with a note. "This literally takes my breath away. It's so insane." The conclusion being that newspapers need more Davises and Dugans. I memoed Ben Bradley separately and intemperately. "I am really embarrassed to think this ignorant, biased fool was ever national editor. Surely the worst asps in this world are the ones one has clasped to the bosom." The public got in on the act also, writing me and others at the Post with a range of opinion on the strike. Someone even wrote to ask, "Haven't all you magnificent geniuses over there figured out yet how to blame your pressroom sabotage on Nixon?" By March 1st, the strike was essentially over. We had had a difficult balancing act to manage, and in the end we had stayed on the tightrope and reached the other side. All the unions, with the exception of the pressmen, were back at work. When it was over, 22 pressmen, including supervisors, came back as individuals out of more than 200 members of the union, and 28 out of 43 stereotypers returned. Some pressmen didn't come back for philosophical reasons and loyalty to the union. Some were no doubt afraid to. I know that one of the supervisors who did come back, Hoot Gibson, was frightened at first. When I asked him what he thought might happen, or what the union could do to him, he responded in his slow West Virginia drawl, "Anything. Anything at all. Why, they could kill your dog or your horse." Hoot and I had a long talk the morning he returned, a talk on which I've never ceased to reflect, about what had brought us to this dreadful mess. Hoot recalled the early days of the Post, in the old E Street building, when "we all enjoyed our work and each other. We used to come in 15 minutes early just to visit before we went to work," he remembered. And he emphasized how much easier it was to relate to each other when the paper was smaller. It's interesting that on one night we had 23 amateurs running the mailroom, and the very next night there were 69 people manning the same equipment. We handled the return to work very carefully, not pressing people who were slow to come back. We wanted to bind up wounds, not create more. We tried to welcome everyone back into the building. We tried not to gloat, although there were many uncertainties at the Post, including the cost of buying out some of the printers and getting back some of the lineage lost during the strike. We had begun to resume normal operations. Despite the 3 months of the strike at the end of the year, we had actually finished 1975 with an increased share of the Sunday field in Washington and with total Post lineage down less than 2%. We still had to come to work through what was an increasingly forlorn picket line, which was awful, and pressmen's wives and children picketed my house in Georgetown every Sunday for months, so I had to drive in and out past their sad line, which bothered me more than anyone will ever know. The picket line at the Post wasn't called off until May of 1977. The pressmen kept resolutely harassing us. They had picketed the opening of the movie All the President's Men, and in July 1976, when I spoke at a bicentennial program at the Washington Monument, pressmen hidden in the audience emerged hooting and yelling and drowned me out. I made a few attempts to keep going, realized they were futile, and suggested we all join hands and sing God Bless America, which had been scheduled for the conclusion. This we did. It was, of course, somewhat nerve-wracking to have them suddenly appear from the dark night, and I left as soon as I could. In June, there was one sign of vindication for the actions we had taken. Superior Court Judge Leonard Brayman issued a findings of fact and conclusions of law in response to a 5-day hearing on our request for a permanent injunction against Local 6. The judge came down hard on the union, saying essentially that in the case of Local 6, the First Amendment's freedom of speech by picketing had gone beyond the pale of protected communication, and coercion has been mingled with speech. In July, 7 former post-pressmen were indicted by a federal grand jury in connection with the opening riot. 4 were also charged with assaulting Jim Hoover, the foreman. 1 was alleged to be a minor hitman for the mafia. A week later, 8 more were indicted on charges of destroying property. In April 1977, a year and a half after the opening salvo, these 15 former pressmen pleaded guilty to misdemeanors ranging from simple assault to disorderly conduct, and were sentenced in May by Judge Sylvia Bacon, who said that their actions during the strike were planned, purposeful, and unjustified. These events did not erupt spontaneously. 6 were jailed, and the rest given suspended sentences and fines. Plea bargaining helped make the sentences fairly mild, but I was happy not to have to go through re-arousing all the old passions in a trial. Dugan had been handed a real defeat, but he too was a victim, in some ways, of his past successes and his own intransigence. In June 1976, he had been defeated in a re-election bid for the presidency of Local 6. Brian Flores, who had masterminded most of the Guild's strategy and run its meetings, had also met his Waterloo. The local Guild leaders tried to bring disciplinary action against members who had crossed the picket lines, not even allowing these people to have their own lawyers. They were to be union trials. In protest, there was a movement to get rid of the Guild, and about a third of the 800 members resigned and formed the Washington Newspaper Union, mounting a challenge to the Guild as the bargaining representative. The independent union only narrowly lost, but it did succeed in getting the international union to realize it would lose the post unless something was done. Leaders of the international persuaded Flores to resign as administrative officer and replaced him. We had weathered a strike we hadn't asked for and didn't control. The post had survived this crucial test, but there was no clean victory. It was a painful one for the post, for its guild and craft union members, and for the Washington community. It divided the paper, creating a false atmosphere of us versus them. Nearly 200 people lost their jobs. 1 committed suicide. There were many sad consequences for far too many people and their families. I never wanted the strike. I know that many people believe I deliberately set out to destroy a union, but that was certainly not the case. And if it had been the case, it would not have worked. Certainly I and everyone in the building who was interested in putting out an on-time quality paper were fed up with the tyranny which the Pressmen's Union had imposed on us over the years. But I never dreamed it was possible to replace the pressmen, nor did I feel it was desirable. Most people at the Post are still represented by unions. As I said early on, the Washington Post has lived long and honorably with its unions. Mark and I both said repeatedly throughout the strike that we believed the Post benefited from strong, healthy trade unionism. I believed that then, and I believe it now. I felt this as the publisher, as well as personally. My father was the only publisher ever made an honorary member of the Pressman's Local 6. I myself had come to maturity in an age of strong labor. I was a believer in the labor movement. One of my earliest aspirations had been to be a labor reporter. Yet I also feel that the unions have to stay productive and that there are areas that need not be unionized. What I stand by unequivocally is that we had no other choice but to do what we did, to take the actions we took. The future of the Post, as well as of the Post Company, hung in the balance. I knew that we had to have a well-run production department. All of our jobs depended on it. I knew that we had to retrieve management rights that had eroded over the years. I have always thought that blame is divisible, and I take responsibility for some of the management problems that led to the eroding of our rights to run the pressroom. Others I inherited. But wherever the source of the problems lay, I knew they had to be corrected. I was also convinced that we set about doing this in an enlightened and decent way. I believe that we offered a generous resolution from the beginning and throughout. We wanted to settle with the Union, but we wanted to settle responsibly. Our aim was always the same. We were asking for the reasonable right to retrieve some of the bad practices that had built up over the years. We tried to be fair, which I know is something many of the pressmen and their families will never believe. We weren't asking the pressmen merely to surrender the outmoded practices to which we objected. We were prepared to give for what we got. We would have willingly bought back what we had earlier given away. The Pressmen's Union was not prepared to give up anything. The Union, or at least its leaders, Dugan and Davis, seemed to be saying, "What's ours is ours and what's yours is negotiable." Ironically, it was the pressmen themselves who made it possible for us to achieve what we had longed for. I view the strike as a great tragedy that could have been avoided with wiser union leadership. I believe, as I wrote someone at the time, that Local 6 killed the goose and its golden eggs with their unbending determination to keep it all. Dugan could see that unions and management at other papers were arriving at contracts that met the needs of both sides at the table. He could also see that some of the best papers in the country at the time, the Los Angeles Times, Newsday, and the Miami Herald, for example, were almost completely non-union. But he remained adamant, refusing to bargain reasonably and act responsibly. Many fine and able pressmen were caught in a bind of having to resign from the union or remain with the leaders who had led them so poorly and had done such harm. There is undoubtedly a tendency to think that unions must be victims and therefore right, and that employers are probably brutal, powerful, and therefore wrong. I felt this was a particularly serious misperception in our case. I understood people who felt loyal to the union and not to the company when forced to make what I knew was a very hard choice, and said as much in letters to the wives of a few of the pressmen. But I also understood that it was a choice these men had made. I felt that the philosophy that any union is right, no matter what it does, was an odd cause for which to sacrifice one's career. I wish the pressmen had influenced their union leadership to be responsible in the first place. Failing that, I wish they had returned as individuals. Unfortunately, many followed Dugan over the cliff. In some ways, we obtained by accident what is given to few in their lives, a new chance. Though this was a strike that was not looked for, it was one that was desperately needed. As I told Ben at the time, in an odd sense, the strike was a business-side Watergate that fell on our heads but then had to be pursued. We had wanted to accomplish gradually over many contracts what we were not only enabled but forced to do in one blow as a result of the strike. After years of defeated hopes at contract times, after the agony of concern about how to turn around a seemingly impossibly difficult mess in production, we were given that rare and unexpected gift we all dream about, a clean slate on which we could begin to rebuild. We now had settled our two worst labor problems, the ITU and the pressmen, in different ways. We could begin to address, in a more orderly way, the rest of them, including the mailroom, where there was still feather bedding and inefficiency. Most important, we had gained the opportunity to deal more professionally with our unions, and the right to upgrade the quality of our production management as well as the ability to manage. We were able to bring in enlightened modern managers, particularly Don Rice and later Tom Might, who together brought production from the worst managed department in the building to the best. The fine current production vice president, Mike Clearman, was the last apprentice printer we hired. It's sobering to look back at the strike and realize that, as with Watergate, one reason we survived is that we were lucky. Granted, we had the strong will of the people inside and outside the building who helped us, the leadership of Mark Mayer and Don Graham, as well as the dedication and ability of the non-union circulation department that distributed and delivered the paper. But we also needed some extraordinarily lucky breaks, and we got them. The initial deliberate destruction of the presses, which seemed at first sight like such an overwhelming catastrophe, turned out to be a blessing in disguise. The damage and the unforgivable acts of violence throughout the strike helped greatly with public opinion, with other newspapers that came to our aid, and above all, with keeping the Guild working. The rampage that some of the pressmen went on straightened our spines on the management side. It made us very determined to come to terms with the arrogance that it reflected. At the time, I was both angry and baffled about the violence. Why did they do it? Only in hindsight did I come to understand it to a certain extent, although never to accept it. Dugan and Davis knew that in order to prevail, they had to shut off either our means of distributing the paper or our means of producing it. Because our distributors were independent operators, the union had no other option than to focus on our means of production, the presses. Also, there had been a strike at a newspaper in Kansas City, and that paper had replaced its striking pressmen the day after they struck, and the union had never gone back. In August 1975, just over a month before our own strike began, the head of the Kansas City Pressmen's Union made a speech to our Local 6 at the Post, saying that their error had been leaving the presses intact and ready to run. I suppose Dugan and Davis decided not to make that same mistake. Larry Wallace suggested that Dugan possibly thought he had figured out a way to succeed where other pressmen had failed. I believe that it was the roughneck out-of-town element of the union who mapped out the damage and sabotage, rather than long-time post-pressmen, the majority of whom I don't think even knew that the damage was planned. In fact, Everett Ray Forsman, a union official who played no role in the violence, left the room in tears after seeing the extent of the damage. Even the weather was on our side. Whereas Washington had experienced some torrential rains in the late summer and early fall, the days remained fairly clear throughout the strike, which allowed the helicopters to fly in and out regularly without being grounded. Though the strike at the Washington Post ended for the most part in February 1976, its reverberations are felt to this day. We learned a lot of necessary, albeit painful, lessons about the need for strong and compassionate managers who are knowledgeable about the tasks at hand, about labor relations, and about communications. And we put what we learned to good use. There were extraordinarily positive outcomes for the company in greater efficiency and flexibility and in the ability to manage. Our increased productivity was evident in the pressroom, where we went from 17 pressmen on each press before the strike to 8 to 10 person crews afterwards. Press speeds increased. For us, it was the equivalent of buying another press. Our pressroom began functioning again the way a pressroom should, and the atmosphere improved throughout the building. As a manager, I had learned the hard way that when management, for whatever reason, forfeits its basic right to manage, only trouble can result. The strike made me more determined to establish better communications within the company, and the result was a better, stronger newspaper. Without the groundwork laid by the strike, we would not have been able to build and to grow. We bounded back from the trauma of the strike because the Post was a good newspaper to begin with, one that people liked, and because our regained control over the pressroom meant that we could print and deliver the paper on time, something we hadn't been doing for years. It is ironic that I, who have never liked confrontations, should have been faced with this major one. My mother rarely did things tactfully or in a low-key way. She loved and thrived on strident confrontations. Perhaps for that reason, I always ran the other way when it came to a showdown. I hated fights, which I always found unpleasant and invariably feared losing. On the other hand, in this big one, when I was cornered, I had no choice but to become embattled. I know that I risk sounding pretentious or sanctimonious when I say that, at bottom, I regarded the actions we took as fulfilling our obligation to our readers. But I'll take the risk and say that, for me, it was true. Yet even when it was over, I had mixed feelings. "It's an awful thing," I wrote a friend in February 1976, "to find yourself engaged in, and curiously emotionally worse in, victory than in battle." It was, as I also said, equally awful to meet people who believed the propaganda emanating from a coalition of enemies that I have suddenly gotten money-grubbing and heartless. I emerged from the strike with a higher profile than ever before. Though at the Post and in the community, some people may have had mixed feelings about me, within the industry, my star had risen. Even those publishers who denounced the so-called liberalism of the Post's news and editorial pages applauded our actions on the management side. To say that I was grateful to many people is a supreme understatement. I was indebted to Mark Mayer for his strength and his many abilities throughout those long months. Don made me proud, as a publisher and as a mother. Larry Wallace proved himself to be a man of great competence and common sense. He had my confidence throughout the negotiations. People in the industry, although they may have helped for the common good, were still extraordinarily generous to take on our problems. Those 125 Post people who worked so hard at their own jobs by day and other jobs by night, doing work normally done by nearly 1,500 full and part-time production people, earned my undying respect and affection. I have always considered the daily paper a miracle of sorts, but never more so than during the strike. Chapter 27. In certain ways, the defining period of my working life was over. During the turbulent years from 1971 to 1976, we had been through the major public dramas of the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, and the Pressman's strike. Ironically, it was the next 5 years that were the most difficult work years I ever lived through. I sometimes felt as if I were being made to pay for having survived those earlier events relatively unscathed. I still saw myself as an inheritor who had been very lucky. But fortunately, after the years of public trauma, I had a fairly steady platform on which to operate. The company's primary businesses, the Post Newsweek and Post Newsweek stations, were all generally progressing, but I still tended to exaggerate the things that were going wrong. Despite the recent successes, my confidence, never solid, was shaken, particularly as I began to be written about more and more for my real and perceived mistakes. Warren's advice and steady communication with me were critical to a number of actions I took in these years. Crucially, he persuaded me of the benefits of buying in our own stock. I had been suspicious of the idea. Repurchasing stock is a commonplace today, but only a handful of companies were doing it in the mid-1970s. I felt that if we spent all of our money buying in our own stock, we wouldn't be able to grow. Warren went through the numbers with me, showing me what this action could do for the company in the long run or even in the short run. He re-emphasized how low the stock was compared with its real value and how this was a better business move than many we were contemplating. He gradually made his point. If we bought in 1% of the stock in the Post Company, everyone owned a larger share of our stock at a bargain price. I decided we should do it. My natural caution, however, was such that I thought I had to convince the people around me of the importance of such a move. So I set about persuading the top executives, including the company's legal counsel, of the rightness of this decision. Finally, we agreed and took it to the board, who okayed the stock repurchases. In fact, the board quickly saw what a good idea this was and didn't want to stop. Over the next 20 years, we bought back 45% of the stock. My management troubles may have derived mainly from my lack of business experience, but they were multiplied by not having a real partner to help me run the company. By the time of the strike, it was clear that Larry Israel, who had been president and chief operating officer of the company since Fritz's death in 1973, was not working out. When I concluded after a great deal of consultation that this situation just wouldn't get better, we made a decision to part ways and announced Larry's resignation in January of 1977. When he left, I took back the title of president, retaining the chairmanship of the company as well, until we decided what to do about a new COO. The announcement of Larry's departure was greeted with a batch of negative stories of which I was the target. Time's piece on the move was titled, "Krusty K Tightens Her Grip." After describing me as difficult to get along with, mercurial, impulsive, manipulated by an éminence grise, meaning Warren, Time concluded by acknowledging, whatever the problems, Graham's company will show record profits and record revenues. I particularly detested the sexist implications of stories like these, always being depicted as the difficult woman, while whoever left the company was the victim of my female whims. I was still a curiosity, a woman in a man's world. Men like Bill Paley, Al Newharth, Mort Zuckerman, and Joe Albritton fired executive after executive, but no one attributed their actions to their gender. Also at this time, I had some grave concerns about the quality of the paper and of the editing. I felt that the national staff and the Metro staff had let down, that we were doing things superficially. Ben didn't agree with me, but Bob Woodward did, putting it succinctly one day, "The paper is going down the shithole." It is to Ben's great credit that he and I survived the difficult times and all my questioning. I could still come on like a dentist drill at moments like this, but he hung in, and balance would get restored. Sometimes he would do things despite my views, and sometimes he was right to do so. If he was mistaken, he would correct the mistakes in time, as soon as he agreed that something wasn't working. Not listening to me and to others was both Ben's strength and his weakness. However, as I wrote him at the time of this disagreement about the quality of the paper, no superficial problems either of us may have at any particular moment matter compared to the basic trust and rapport with each other, because if that's there, and it is there as far as I'm concerned, all else flows from it. Another area I was worried about at the Post was the editorial page. Phil Jalen seemed to go into a prolonged slump after Watergate. I tried to assure him that, though I felt the page needed revitalizing, I had confidence in his ability to do it. I talked to him about how the complexity of my job and the pressures on my time had left me out of touch with him somewhat. I no longer participated to the extent I had earlier in editorial and management meetings at either the Post or at Newsweek. I assured Phil that I would try to remedy the situation and help in any way I could. There were also problems at Newsweek. The magazine was doing well in operating revenue, and the business was remarkably good. On the editorial side, however, 1976 was the beginning of some high-level management turnover that affected both the magazine and me personally. In October of that year, after leaving and returning to the magazine, Oz Elliott, who had been Newsweek's editor-in-chief and board chairman, suggested a sabbatical so that he could help save New York. Convinced that his mind was on other things, I had to let him go, and not just on sabbatical. Our mutual affection withstood the trauma, and I have nothing but admiration and gratitude for Oz, who left to become deputy mayor of New York City. Ed Kosner, who had become editor in September of 1975, remained responsible for the general editorial direction of the magazine. When Oz departed, Bob Campbell, who had become Newsweek's president in 1975, assumed Oz's title of chairman and was succeeded as president by Peter DeRoe, who had come to Newsweek straight out of Harvard Business School in 1965. Peter was, I thought, an able, ambitious, attractive young man who knew his business. I saw him or talked to him frequently, believed in him, thought of him as an associate I could lean on, and viewed him as the promise of the future. Although I considered myself inadequately educated and experienced for the role I was playing, I did think I was pretty good at appraising people and their performance. In fact, Peter's performance was fine in many ways, and he had smoothly worked his way up to the number two position under Bob Campbell. I had realized that he was highly political, never a healthy sign, but I was stunned one day in the middle of 1977 when he told me he was leaving to become an administrative vice president at CBS. I was disappointed by that, but he didn't stop there, going on to tell me that he wanted to be in a healthy, vibrant, well-run company as opposed to the poorly run one I was operating. He said that he felt I was a hopelessly inadequate leader and that he had little choice but to leave for the dynamic CBS. He touched a raw sensitivity when he assaulted me for not being a professional manager, and I must confess that I wept on and off for at least 2 days. I didn't acknowledge to myself that his was a highly irregular way to leave a company in which he had achieved success and that had done well by him for 12 years. Embarrassed as I am to admit it, I worried so much about losing this man that I actually offered him the presidency of the entire Post Company if he would stay. Peter was determined to leave, however, and told me it would take too much out of him to take on the job. He was 37 at the time, I believe. The issue, he said, wasn't a specific position or a title at the company, but rather, do I want to spend the next 10 years educating myself and educating the family as to how this business ought to be run? He added that to stay at the Washington Post Company would take someone with much more patience than I have. A few weeks later, he departed with encomiums from us, elaborate speeches from me about how wonderful he was. Privately, I knew that I wouldn't soon forget the personal verbal lashing I had taken from him, and I worried about how right he might have been. In one of the more bizarre events of my working life, just 6 months later, Peter and I had lunch together in New York, and he sounded me out about returning to Newsweek. Unaccountably, stupidly, despite the powerfully deflating effect of all he had said to me, I said yes right away and welcomed him back, especially since we had not yet found his successor. In another month, he was once again president of Newsweek. At the company, in corporate, from the time of Larry Israel's departure in February 1977 until close to the end of that year, I was essentially alone as both chairman and president, and was still the publisher of the Post. But Warren was supporting me, figuratively at least, on one side, and Don Graham was growing increasingly important on the other, and at the end of 1976, we had promoted Mark Mayer to president of the newspaper division. Simultaneously, Mark named Don executive vice president and general manager of the Post, responsible for its day-to-day operation. In November 1977, we promoted Mark to president and chief operating officer of the entire company. Mark was young, and in some respects short on experience and maturity, but he had done a good job for us, especially during the strike, and not being quite sure what I was looking for, I thought it better to stay with a known quantity. In the mid-1970s, my focus was on how to grow the company. The question of growth and acquisition had never been addressed in an orderly way. Neither Fritz nor I had known how to go about it, and in fact had rather unqualified people passing judgment on important issues. We had little more than a hit-or-miss strategy, with no logical point of departure, no consistent way of analyzing possible purchases, and no experience with negotiating targets we were aiming at. Of course, at least in the early 70s, our debt was still considerable, and our profits were not large enough to give us much leeway to grow, so in some ways the point was moot. But I wanted to be poised for growth when the opportunity presented itself. Basically, I was baffled even about how to organize a group to think about expansion. As it was, one person might make a suggestion, and the idea would lie on the table, while several of us chewed on it in mostly unanalytical ways. At one moment in mid-1979, Joel Chaseman, president of Post Newsweek Stations, and Mark Mayer, among others, were pushing for us to undertake a cable news network. I disapproved of the idea for us, but there was such a head of steam that I let them present it to the board, which turned it down. Although their memories and mine are at odds about the chronology of all this, I thought that the idea had not only already been conceived by Ted Turner, but had begun to be implemented. He was very determinedly barreling ahead, even though his network was not yet launched. There clearly wasn't room for two such enterprises, if there was room for one, a real concern of mine at the time. In fact, it took many years for Turner's cable news network to become a success, and only now are several other companies entering the field. I started to look into properties that I'd hear were available. Warren was of especial help on acquisitions, knowing to some degree about almost every deal that was taking place or had taken place in the previous 10 years. One potential acquisition we considered was a television station in Buffalo. Warren advised me that the newspaper, which was also for sale, would be a better buy, and if we didn't want it, he did. Although dominant in its market, The paper had strong competition, strong unions, and no Sunday edition. When we decided not to pursue it, Warren bought it, and after considerable struggle, managed it to great success. I still feel we made the right decision for us. How ill-prepared we were to manage another smaller paper was amply demonstrated by the problems we were having with the Trenton Times, which we had bought in the spring of 1974. I had shared with Warren a memo describing and evaluating the deal and using some valuation parameters that caused him consternation, though he didn't mention it at the time. Obviously, we hadn't done sufficient research into the market. Nowhere in the memo, according to Warren, was there any indication that Trenton was not a single newspaper town, the competition being a lively morning paper. In evaluating the deal, the memo used illustrations from monopoly cities. Warren apparently went into orbit at the oversight, but was restrained since he wasn't yet on the board. We offered $16 million for the property, probably about $4 million too much. I had enough sense so that when, at the last minute, one of the sisters in the family selling the paper wanted more money, and it looked as if the deal might be held up, I said, "Good, let's can it. If they want more money, just say no. Let's use this opportunity to walk away." I had reacted instinctively, but everyone else in the meeting, including Larry Israel, Mark Mayer, and Ben, rose up to say, "What's the matter with you? Don't you want this company to grow? Don't you want to make any acquisitions?" I certainly did, but I didn't want to buy trouble. Unfortunately, with the Trenton Times, an afternoon paper in an era when we knew what was happening to our afternoon competition in Washington, that's what we would be getting. Nevertheless, I relented, and we took possession of the Trenton Times, adding another worry to my list of concerns. Indeed, we never learned to manage the paper, and we ran it abysmally. It's true that we also were in the throes of a bad economy. There were circulation and advertising lineage setbacks right from the start. We hired some excellent people, and some who used the job as a springboard to the Post, but we overloaded the paper with people more appropriate for Washington than for the Trenton Times. We made every management mistake in the book, including offending and alienating the local establishment with a particularly savage style-like report on one of the city's main social events, criticizing people's clothes, bibulous behavior, and so on. We had a succession of mostly inappropriate publishers, who, with one exception, didn't understand the community. We edited the paper well by our standards, but poorly by theirs. Instead of thinking about what was the right paper for this particular community, we seemed to edit the paper as though we were thinking of what the community should read. I think there was some arrogance involved. We were going to bless them with a minor version of the Washington Post. Some people derisively referred to it as the Washington Post North. In the meantime, the Trentonian, a feisty morning tabloid owned by Ralph Ingersoll in partnership with Mark Goodson, was giving blue-collar Trenton what it enjoyed. It was a clever paper, produced inexpensively and inoffensively, with an emphasis on amusement. We started a Saturday morning newspaper to try to go head-to-head with the Trentonian, which countered by starting a Sunday paper to compete directly with ours. We may not have been losing money, but we weren't near the profit goals we'd set or been led to believe were possible. This was our first newspaper acquisition after the Post, but it was layered away from me and continued to be mismanaged most of the time we had it. Because the Washington Post Company now had a much higher profile, particularly after Watergate, how badly we were doing in Trenton became a big deal. We were widely written up, and our troubles were highlighted. At one time, I made the foolish statement, which was how I felt, that it was our Vietnam. There seemed to be no solution and no way out. This was not our shining moment. However, by now, we were in a position to add to the company, and we kept looking for compatible properties throughout the communications industry. Among the businesses that we approached, or that approached us, were New York Magazine, The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Random House, and Simon & Schuster. But the first three didn't work out, and the two publishing houses were just too large to bite off, or so we thought. We also missed on the newspaper in Wilmington, Delaware, and we declined a bid on the Denver Post. An important deal that we did make was prompted by our concerns about having the number one newspaper and number one television station in Washington and being viewed as a media monopoly at a time when the FCC was looking hard at situations of cross-ownership. The Supreme Court was soon going to be deciding a case relevant to this issue, whether a company that owned a newspaper could also own a television station in the same town or market. Companies in these situations were worried about the outcome. Our communications lawyers advised me to consider trading WTOP